I'm Faith Middleton. It's great to have you joining the party on the Food Schmooze here on WNPR in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. My food buddies are here. Chris Brassberry of Metro Beast Restaurant in Simsbury, Connecticut, senior producer Lori Mack, and producer Jonathan McNichol. Hey, everybody.
Hey.
And you can tell your friends, no matter where they live, they can listen to the Food Schmooze from anywhere in the world, as many people do, at WNPR.org. All right, it is time for our hot chocolate party.
My Cocoa favorite.
Time. On the Food Schmooze. We have recipe ideas for you now at our website, WNPR.org. Just click on Programs for the Faith Middleton Show. They're up there right now. Or at any point when you decide you're going to have a party, a few people over, just go to the site. It'll still be there. So I asked everybody here to find a hot chocolate recipe. But let me tell you what to do in a pinch, because I don't know if this has happened to you. You just all of a sudden you either get up in the morning, which is usually my habit, or it's, you know, it's sometime in the evening and it's freezing and you just say, I'd love a little touch of hot chocolate.
A package of Swiss Miss.
Well, that's an option.
That is the easiest way. But here's I start the day every day with a square of Green and Black's organic dark chocolate, 85%.
That's not a bad way to start.
Yeah. I mean,
just start.
So this past weekend, it's all I had. I didn't have any bag of cocoa or tin of cocoa around the house. And so I had some milk in the refrigerator. So I looked at it and I went, And so I just, you know, broke off a few pieces of it, put it in a pan and very slowly melted it, poured in some milk, stirred it with a little whisk, and just kept stirring till the thing was very hot. And that was it. I just poured it into a little teacup, and it was silky and dark and rich, and I felt like I was in Paris.
That's good chocolate.
It was very, very good. You know, I mean, there was something so pure about it. It really was like Parisian chocolate.
Did you sweeten it or didn't eat it?
No, didn't eat it. No, because it has a little bit of sugar in it. Yeah. So I have my recipe for Mexican hot chocolate coming up. Jonathan, what did you come up with?
I found one that's really simple. It's for peanut butter cocoa, and you do it in a slow cooker.
Oh, that is fantastic.
Are you serious?
I knew Chris was going to be all excited. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, very simple.
I have just the slow cooker.
Jonathan,
for that.
How does this work?
It's just instant milk chocolate, hot water, chocolate syrup, peanut butter, and a little vanilla.
Wow.
In the slow cooker. And how long does it stay in there? Just a short while?
3 to 4 hours.
Nice.
That's on the low
heat.
That's a real party.
Oh, my gosh.
9 servings. Peanut butter.
Oh, well, that is really fun.
How about a little amaretto for adults in there, right?
Yeah. There you go.
Jonathan, I thought you were going to try and figure out how to get your, soda.
Yeah, Mountain Dew. Mountain Dew
in there somehow. I thought, I know it's going to be chocolate Mountain Dew. Good find. Okay, and Lori, what do you have?
I have to say, I started making my own hot chocolate a long time ago when Maria was really little, basically because I wanted to know what was going in her little body.
Aww.
And I continued doing it because I was really impressed with the fact that I could control the sweetness.
Oh, sure.
So I used to just take regular cocoa powder and some milk and heat it up, and then I'd use maple syrup as a sweetener. Now, very recently, I was standing over my boring little hot cocoa recipe, and I thought, I wonder if I could make this an adult hot cocoa. And I knew I had some dark rum, and I was wondering if that would work. So I looked online for hot cocoa using dark rum, and sure enough, I found just the thing. It's optional, of course, and it's delicious without the rum. But Nigella Lawson has this great recipe, and here's what it is.
Did I say that?
She's easy to love. It's milk. She recommends a high-quality chocolate, like Faith mentioned. It can be bittersweet, dark, semi-sweet. I happen to have semi-sweet chocolate, so I use that. You melt that. You add a cinnamon stick, vanilla, a little bit of brown sugar, a little bit of honey, and then...
Wow, that's a lot of sugar.
If you want, but it's like teaspoons.
No, it's interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
It's interesting because the cinnamon gives it that little extra depth. Mm-hmm. The vanilla thing, it adds that little something. Yeah. It makes it a little more complex. And then, if you want, you can add your dark rum, which I did for my cup of hot chocolate. And it was quite tasty.
That
highly recommend it.
Very
that good.
Very good. Now, these are at our website right now, WNPR.org. click on programs for the Faith and Milton show.
Okay, now I feel kind of lame.
Before I get to Mexican, okay,
I thought about this last night, and should I look up a recipe or should I just go with the way I do hot chocolate at home? And now I'm embarrassed to say I went with the way I do hot chocolate at home. You ready?
Well, we need something plain.
I do Ovaltine. Because I grew up on it.
Old school.
Old school.
You get some vitamins, too.
And I do mini marshmallows.
Yeah.
So I heat up a little milk, right? I heat up, and again, just and when we were kids, we used whole milk, but now I use skim milk or 2%. And then I just spoon in the Ovaltine. It's really easy. And then I just drop in, the little
baby
marshmallows.
And you don't put additional.
No.
Ovaltine anyway?
It's a hot cocoa that's fortified with vitamins and stuff. Yeah. So, yeah. It's
and you don't put additional chocolate or cocoa or anything.
I don't know.
You like that flavor.
You know, I think it's more about bringing it back to your childhood, right? Mm-hmm. It's not for me anyway. For me, it's not about getting fancy with hot chocolate. Because when I've had chocolate for the first time, of course, you're a little kid. It's snowing outside. So whenever I have my Ovaltine with my mini marshmallows, it sort of takes me back to those days.
Oh, that's good.
Now I want mini marshmallows.
Yeah.
So there's a great hot chocolate seller in Walpole, New Hampshire. I was visiting friends there, and that was driven into the town of Walpole, which is the most charming village. And there is a place called Burdick's, B-U-R-D-I-C-K. They're all about chocolate. They make their own chocolate. They source beans from different countries.
Oh,
you can buy many kinds of chocolate bars, and you can buy many kinds of bean mixtures for your hot cocoa. So different strengths and profiles. You know, one might be Brazilian and another one might be some kind of other African thing. You can go online to them, burdicks.com. I order from them, or when I'm stopping by or when my friends are there and coming to see me, I say, bring me a bag of that hot chocolate. Here's the hot chocolate that I call it boozy. You can use alcohol or not, but I call it boozy Mexican hot chocolate. Nice. And this is something I had found at Epicurious.com. I'm going to do it from memory. It has evaporated milk. You know, 2% you can get in the can. So can of evaporated milk. And you mix the evaporated milk with whole milk. You have lots and lots. This serves about, I think, 8 or 10 people. Lots and lots of cinnamon sticks. You have cocoa powder, and you also have a dark chocolate pieces that you break up, a little bit of vanilla, and ancho chili powder, and a red chili.
Oh, so, I bet that's delicious.
It's in the spicy side. And the alcohol is a chocolate liqueur, you know, your favorite brand.
Yeah.
And it comes together in this most simple way, in the way that we all make hot chocolate. Yeah. So there's no point in going into all that, and it's on our website. Yeah. But it has a wonderful complexity, a little bit of, spicy heat to it, but not something that would knock you over the head.
And smokiness from the etchos, too, right?
Definitely smokiness, yeah.
Wow, that's
wonderful.
Probably amazing.
It really is terrific. And then what I do is make whipped cream, and it's in the recipe to make your whipped cream. And, you know, people make flavored whipped creams to put on hot chocolate. You can do that. Mm-hmm. I make the whipped cream plain to put on the hot chocolate because on top of the whipped cream, I crush dark chocolate covered pretzels.
So that you
get that
kind of salty
thing going on.
I've been at your house. I never got, hey, Chris, you want a hot cocoa? I would totally have said yes if you said you want a
And it even has pretzels on the top.
And it even has pretzels on top.
I'm thinking, Jonathan, from your slow cooker, can I make it?
Totally.
Yeah, interesting.
In the slow cooker. You think I can?
Totally.
Chris, you're the
and
slow cooker.
And it would be easy. And again, then you don't have to worry about overheating the chocolate. All those things are out the door.
And it stays warm during the party.
Right. Just give it a little whisk every once in a while.
You know what is so fantastic about the hot chocolate party is I was saying, at the website that the cocktail party's gone the way of the dodo bird, really. So throw a hot chocolate party instead. Yeah. It's so easy. It's all prepared in advance. You can have alcohol or not have alcohol in your drink, depending on whether you have kids there. If you've got gluten-free people, they are taken care of because there are a zillion hot cocos that are gluten-free, many of them just by nature. And there's nothing else in there except for the pretzels on top, and you can have a bowl of them. People can add them if they want. And then if you've got vegans coming to your party, you just put on another pan of almond milk. You know, or another crock pot of almond milk, and they'll be very, very grateful, and they can use anything you've got on the table to make what they need. So this is the kind of go-to way to have a party that is so easy. You know what? You don't even have to put out another thing. You could have some cookies out there if you want.
I could see going ice skating on a Saturday afternoon,
right?
And then afterwards you all meet up at your house and...
I could see this just being dessert after a dinner party.
Oh, true. Yeah. You just, this is just a reason to get people together. And you just say, come over for hot chocolate, period. You know, it's just so easy
and then
easy
surprise
and
them
fun.
With something like that. When you say hot chocolate, you're like, huh. But with the hot chocolates we've talked about today, it's really taking them up a level.
Yeah, but in case they're a kid, you want to, you know, figure out in advance if you're going to have one with alcohol and one without alcohol. You know the drill.
I got
kids
plenty
get
of
the
crock
sweet
pots.
Ones. Okay, right.
So
I could have
all of these
hot chocolates.
Is there one thing you would love besides cookies? I always think of shortbread when I think of hot chocolate. But is there anything that anybody would like to have as a little treat with hot chocolate? Go for it.
A little pound cake, maybe?
Yeah.
Pound cake, okay.
I was thinking banana bread or something like that.
That'd
right?
be good.
Yeah. I wonder if you should do a yin-yang thing and have maybe a tub of vanilla ice cream. You know, where you
could
had
you
hot and cold.
In there? Could you float it in there?
Think
and it wouldn't be hot
cool down
for very
your
long.
Hot chocolate, I think. But I suppose you could. Okay. So go online.
Awesome.
All of our hot chocolate recipes are up there at WNPR.org. Ahead, we've got how to use mushrooms as if they're meat, and that is from the book Lust for Leaf. I'm going to tell you about the Food Schmooze Champagne Romance Dinner Dance just in time for Valentine's Day. So if you're present shopping, you want to surprise someone you love, it can be a romantic partner, your father, you can take one of the kids. We have star chefs coming to this thing. Really amazing sit down wine and dinner at the Society Room in Hartford. We'll tell you all about that and so much more. I'm Faith Middleton. I hope you will make a charitable contribution to Feed the Hungry. More mouth-watering conversation and fun here on the Food Schmooze. We'll be right back.
Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread had a fight. Beans knocked cornbread out of sight. Beans. Cornbread said, "Now that's all right. Beans. Meet me on the corner tomorrow night. I'll be ready.
I'm Faith Middleton. The Food Schmart here on WNPR is heard Wednesdays at 3 and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at noon. You can join the conversation with us on Facebook. Simply search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to our talented crew, senior contributor Chris Prosperi of Metro Beast Restaurant in Simsbury, Connecticut, Eugene Abatruda, Marion Roy, senior producer Lori Mack, and producer Jonathan McNichol. We thank you first and foremost for listening. All right. This is how we get through the winter. We have these events, these parties that we schedule.
And keeps us going.
Here comes a Faith Middleton Food Schmooze signature event. It is Champagne Romance Dinner Dance Time. I hope you will join me for my fifth annual heart-to-heart wine dinner dance. That's February 12th at the beautiful Society Room downtown Hartford with parking right next door attached. Music by Alex Nakamovsky and his orchestra. Amazing singers come with him. Wines, what a portfolio from Frederick Wildman and Sons, including Champagne. And the stars of our multi-course wine dinner include chefs Jeffrey Lozada from On 20, from Caseus Jason Sobozinski, from Chamard Vineyards Brad Stabinski, from Bell Terrace Stefan Drago, from Metro Beast Restaurant in Simsbury Chris Brosberry.
Who's that?
From Max Fish, David Sellers, Jeffrey Crawford from Jordan Caterers. What a lineup. And we've been planning the menu, trying out things, matching wines, getting this all ready. It's February 12th.
It's coming.
To celebrate Valentine's Day. You might want to surprise somebody. And again, you can bring a romantic partner. You can bring a family member. You can bring a child. I mean, really, and they're dancing of all kinds, and it is so much fun. And the dress is festive. You can just make it whatever you want. We have a lighting designer who's going to be doing something very special for the room. And we're picking linens and glassware and flatware and plates right now. Just, we're going with a color theme. It's going to be really quite beautiful.
And it's a gorgeous room, isn't it? It takes you back to a different era. That whole dance, Saturday night, go out dancing kind of time.
That's true. Okay, now, so here's, it's $90 per person to benefit WNPR. We're going to have candlelight. The idea is to dance and dine the night away with someone you love. $90 per person. Seating is limited. It has sold out every single year. It is a really a good time. And you can go online to WNPR.org or email kginther@WNPR.org. I will tell you that if you go to our site, WNPR.org, you'll see a box for the event, or you can just search programs for the Faith Middleton Show, and there'll be a button right there to join us for the fifth one. I think we're pretty exciting. This is our fifth anniversary.
When you said that, I was stunned.
Isn't that amazing?
I can't believe it's the fifth one.
Yeah. So we're going to do, we're going to try. We have a little surprise at this one. We're going to try something special. So, oh boy, can't wait, can't wait, can't wait. I hope to see you there. So we cruise all kinds of publications, and we go to blogs online. We watch food shows on TV. It is my job to curate all kinds of things for you. And so this time we're going to do our tricks and tips. And so I've passed them out like cards. It's like we're going to play poker here on the show. All right. What have we got? Chris, I love the thing in my kitchen that I love. This is a great gift for somebody. And if you've got a birthday coming up, I love the magnetic knife strip that
and this is
on my wall.
Yeah, okay, this is a good use for it.
I like going over and just whipping off the knife that I see and snap it back on. Okay,
I agree. Now, this is a great tip from Wendy Nichols in San Francisco, California, and she uses it for keeping her metal measuring cups. It keeps them clean. It keeps them neat. So you just take them and you snap them on there face out, and you can see, you know, which is which. They're not stacked in the, like in my house, in a drawer somewhere. And I can never find the one I'm looking for. You're always looking for the quarter cup. You find the half cup. You never find the ones. And this keeps them well organized.
And you're in the drawer, and I'm piling through all kinds of things. Yeah. I love this idea.
And this keeps
it
neat and organized. It's a great tip. And I have a lot of these, and I never thought about using it for like that. But yeah,
These are from our friends at Cooks Illustrated, so we thank them. Okay, so I'm a big polenta lover, and so to keep it from clumping up, you know, that you're always being told that you should pour the cornmeal in this thin stream, and you know the water starts to boil, and then you do the thin stream, and then you start with the whisk, and you whisk in it, and you're trying not to get it to clump. So here's a suggestion from Ray Nazai of Herndon, Virginia. He's discovered that adding the cornmeal to cold water in the pot and stirring it while it's cold to break up the clumps before you heat it gives you the same creamy results. And he says it doesn't clump. And I am so excited about this. I'm going to do this because I love polenta.
Chris is raising his hand.
That's because it's the only way I do it. I don't care what a chef who taught me how to do it. I was like, why can't you just put it in a cold? Oh, you can't do it that way. I've been doing it that way forever, and it never clumps. Because no matter what you do, when you have the boiling water and the slow, steady stream, you totally get clumps.
But why couldn't you do it? I mean,
of course you can do it in cold water.
But what's the argument for why you can't?
Because the old French chefs, and this was an old French chef, was like, you do it that way because
Let me ask you this.
The way we do it.
What happens if we put spaghetti in cold water and
then
heat the water?
Totally can be done.
What is the story with this?
I don't know. You know, it totally can be done. You can also, I'll throw this one at you too. You can also, if you have the stubby like a penne or a rigatoni, you can do it in small amounts like you do risotto.
Uh-huh.
Right? So in other words, you saute some onions or whatever, you throw your dry pasta in, add some white wine, and then just little by little, just keep adding water or stock to it until it's cooked.
Whoa. Oh, that's good.
I mean, there's so many. I think that's the cool thing about cooking.
Here we go.
So many different ways.
Yeah.
Why would you do that, though? What do you gain from doing that?
The water stays in, and the sauce, whatever you're cooking it in, stays. You don't water it down. So if you do it with chicken broth, you get a really good flavor.
Cutting some steps out, basically.
All right. Yeah. So say it again. So because I know this is what's going to happen.
This
people
is a good
are going to say, "Wait a minute, what did he say?" You can always go online and listen to the podcast. But go ahead.
You can make pasta, especially it's tougher to do with the longer pieces. But if you have rigatoni or orchietta or any of those short, stubby styles of pasta,
elbows,
all those, you can make it like you do risotto. So saute some onion, right, and a little bit of olive oil, and throw in your dry pasta.
Dry.
Add a little bit white wine, right, or red wine like you would do risotto, get that reduced, and then just ladle by ladle, add stock, keep reducing it as you go until the pasta's cooked.
So now I've got chicken stock infused with wine, pasta, and what am I doing with it?
You can do whatever you want with it. Throw some cooked or roasted mushrooms in with it and a little truffle oil on top and some Parmesan cheese. You could throw already cooked chicken in there. I mean, again, just like you would do any pasta. But
I just wanted to see what sauces you would go for.
Yeah.
That would overwhelm that chicken stock flavor.
Yeah, or you could do a touch a little cream and butter at the end. I mean, that's, again, the cool thing about cooking.
Parmigiano Reggiano.
Yeah, the cool thing about cooking these days is there are no rules. You can pretty much experiment.
Unless you're a baker.
Oh, yeah. My father's been a pastry chef for many years. We don't invade that.
Right. Why Chris wears garlic around his neck.
Yeah.
It's about the bacon.
It keeps the pastry chefs away.
and vampires, but okay.
Same thing.
Jonathan,
yeah, there you go.
Tricks and tips. I love this cake tester in my girlfriend's drawer. It's fantastic. Old school red handle cake tester.
Mm.
And we actually use it for cakes and mostly for cornbread because I love cornbread. But there are so many things to do with this thing, Jonathan.
This is a trick for the way you lose the cake testers in your
drawer.
Yeah, your drawer of random utensils. And
that would be me. That's why I do
that. And hopefully not batteries and rubber bands.
We are so
maybe
protective with our cake tester that it goes in a very special place. Okay, go ahead.
So Denise Whitley of Norway, Maine came up with. She just sticks them in a dedicated salt shaker right through the holes in the top like a pin cushion.
What a good idea.
The other thing about this.
So then they're just always there.
Is that when you have clumpy salt and the holes in your salt shaker, you know, the silver top one, are all clogged up.
No, they're not.
And you're banging it every which way. You just use a kick tester as a reamer.
As a little reamer.
And go into the salt because it's clumped up too. You know, during picnics, bring it out on the table, but don't lose that cake tester.
So the little salt shaker with all these cake testers sticking out of it could look a little torture.
Can the cake tester?
it's a voodoo salt shaker.
Can the cake tester go on the knife rack?
Totally.
Is it the right metal?
One. Yeah, if it's a metal one. They come in different metals. Yeah, I'm sure if you had the right kind of metal one.
So that's good.
I'm thinking about all the things you could put on that magnetic strip.
What were you thinking?
My whisk is going there because I always lose that. I have a metal spatula that I can never find.
You
know what? I was thinking that too. You know what? And I do this. I don't buy the knife one. Because in my mind, it's not industrial enough.
Okay.
I go to Home Depot and I buy the ones for the tools because then you could put a metal cleaver that weighs 5 pounds on the thing. And I mean, because those magnets are made to hold wrenches.
Yeah, that's right.
And
right.
I bet you can
get
a big
get
one with
off?
A pot. Yeah, you take the end. Sometimes it takes two hands, but it gets off of there.
Chris just went.
Calling up my neighbor next door.
That's on our show.
Mary next door. Joe, can you come over?
Help me get the knife off.
You just tie it to the back of your car and drive.
You know, sometimes on the ones that are a little wimpier, the knife starts to slide a little bit if it's a heavy knife. And I decided years ago I would go get the big heavy one from Home Depot.
It's smart. That's
and
a good
this
idea.
Thing, I'm telling you, nothing's coming off.
And I bet
it's
cheaper.
Thing.
Is
it's
it
probably,
cheaper?
Yeah, of
I don't know.
It's
maybe
cheap.
It's
yeah,
not.
No, I mean, and
well, you
me,
could have your tools up there too.
Nothing's coming off this thing. The whole building, my whole house could shake, and those knives are staying on that magnetic
but
strip.
Are people with like fillings? Are they in pain in your kitchen? Is there? It's like an MRI machine.
I think it's the magnets.
I know, this is like, I'm thinking about. You know, some guy and, you know, a husband and wife and guy saying to his friends, I married the best woman. Our kitchen utensils and our tools are on the same rack. She's the best woman.
Hand me a knife. I mean a Phillips screwdriver.
a ball peen hammer.
It's really fun. Really, really fun. You know, that was the great thing about Julia Child's kitchen. And Jacques Pepin's pegboard. Kitchen is like this, too. He's got, you know, a fantastic pegboard in his kitchen.
But those were made for tools.
You know, the thing with Julia that she did was to draw, because there were so many pots.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She would draw the size, you know, with a marker on the pegboard, and so she knew exactly where to put which thing so
that
it all
excellent.
Fit. Her
yeah.
husband first designed all the shapes so they all fit together, and then she would know where to put
it's
it.
It's like those kid toys with the wooden
that's
things.
Right.
That
yeah.
fit
and
in
I think
it.
You
that's
can see
excellent.
That, right? Isn't it at the Smithsonian?
Yes. Yeah.
Institute? So you could go check
yeah.
it out.
I always say chefs, you always, because I do hang at Home Depots and Lowe's every once in a while in local hardware stores, and you always see chefs in there snooping around looking for stuff.
Oh, sure. Why not?
Because hardware stores are really cool for kitchen. The Rasp. The most amazing little zester ever created on earth in my mind, right?
Why is it better than the microplane?
That
zester?
Is the microplane. But I say Rasp.
But the Rasp doesn't have holes in it the
yes,
way the microplane
does.
Yeah,
of course it does.
It does?
The Rasp, the microplane came from the hardware store. It was actually a device that went on a little handheld planer.
So what if the tool that I have in my tool bag, I have, you know, it's long and mm-hmm. it has raised points on it. Mm-hmm. And it's a Rasp,
yep.
but there are no holes. I mean, in other words, the points would grab the zest off the lemon.
Yeah.
And you'd have to brush it off, but there's no falling through to the other side with the little holes the way the microplane does. So are we talking about the same thing?
We're talking about
I have a Rasp?
We're talking about the same thing used for different things. Basically, all those tools were designed for basically taking off small amounts
yeah,
of wood.
But don't you wiggle out of this. Does yeah. the Rasp actually have holes in it?
I don't know which one you have. You have to show me.
Okay.
I do know there are
this
sanders
is a tough
and
interview
planers.
Right here.
It is. But you
don't
know what? You know
out.
What? We have to go to Home Depot and
60
check.
60 minutes on this.
No, we have to go to Home Depot and go down the planing and sanding aisle.
All right.
So. Not John Miller anyway.
Right, here we go.
I'm in the hot seat over a Rasp. This is a first. Where's the bell?
So, it's a lot of firsts.
So when you do, you know the dessert, croquembouche.
Sure.
I know you know, but for anyone who doesn't know, it's, let me see, how do I explain this? You use a blowtorch. And you have what kind of like the version of puff pastry balls that go on the outside. And they are coated with the, what is the sugar?
Sponge sugar.
Sponge sugar.
Yeah.
Then you take the torch,
yeah.
the blowtorch, and you fire it.
Yeah.
And so it becomes crackling on the
yeah.
outside. And it's got cream. And oh, it's a beautiful thing. It's shape of a Christmas tree. Croquembouche.
Yeah,
okay.
My dad always had tool. It was funny because I was
so
always wondering
kitchen,
why my dad had a
chainsaw.
Yeah, blowtorch, and my dad had a chainsaw.
For his ice sculpture.
Yeah, and yeah. I was like, why does dad have a chainsaw in his office? And it's because it's
for
pastry.
Turkeys.
No, the pastry chefs used to do the ice carvings
oh,
back in the
huh.
day. Yeah, so they had chainsaws,
wow.
they had blowtorches.
We have so much going on here. Okay, let's get back to tricks and tips, even though we've just given you so many.
Yes.
This is about bacon, of course, and bacon grease. So what happens for people who want to save bacon grease, because there are many uses for this. You can put a teaspoonful into a tomato soup, for instance, and, you know, or a tablespoonful, and it is unbelievable. Or if you're doing, you know, whole canned tomatoes as the base of your tomato soup, you just put a tablespoon or two in the bottom of your sauté pan, and then do your tomatoes and onions and garlic in the bottom in the bacon grease, and it is astounding. It's so good.
Happy.
So that's one, you know, there's a million things. Some people will cook potatoes in bacon grease. It depends what you're going to do, but people save bacon grease.
My brother puts it in his vodka and then puts it in the freezer and then strains it out.
So I do it
bacon
with, I put
mango.
The bacon fat into bourbon and put it in the freezer.
Same thing.
The top freezes.
Yeah, and then you just take it
and
off.
And then you just pull that that chunk of frozen fat off the top, strain the bourbon, and then there you're good to go. And it has this smoky flavor in the bourbon. It's easy to do. It's a great kind of present for people. It's a great surprise when people come over and you pour bourbon. Anyway, for those who want to save bacon grease, this has happened to me. It's tricky to pour it into something. The pan is usually quite heavy. It's very hot. Trying to find some kind of item on the counter, and you've got a strainer. So you're trying to do all of this, and so there's many steps. And so Sue Balcom writes in from North Dakota to Cook's Illustrated. She said it's usually a messy task for her, and she's always asking somebody to help her. So here's what she does. She takes a mason jar, just like the one, Jonathan, that you drink your Mountain Dew out of. She takes a mason jar.
Oh, I've been exposed as a hipster right on the radio, right there.
And she puts a tea infuser jar, really, in the top of it. So you know that little tiny strainer that works for loose tea. She puts that in the top, and then by herself can just take the pan on both sides, turn it over, and pour the bacon grease right through. It strains out the little bits of bacon, and the grease is in the jar.
Idea.
Put the lid on, boom, ready to go straight into the freezer. Nice. So I think that's a terrific idea. Quickly, Lori, if you're making bread, you've got it covered in a bowl. It's called proofing because it's rising and you want it to be room temperature. Usually we cover it with plastic wrap and then it all sticks. And then you're pulling off dough and it's a mess.
Right.
So
and a lot of people spray oil on that plastic wrap, but you are also presented with an additional challenge. The plastic wrap actually clings to itself. So Jenny Johnson of River Falls, Wisconsin, says what she does is she drapes the plastic over top of the bowl, then she sprays it, then she quickly flips that sprayed plastic so that now the sprayed side is facing the dough, and then she wraps the bowl.
That's good.
Good tips.
So please support your local food growers. We're going to tell you how to make a vegetarian po' boy with mushrooms. Support your local food growers and food makers. Find the food, wine, recipes, and cocktails and events, including our Champagne Romance Dinner Dance that we feature online anytime and right now at WNPR.org. Click on Programs for the Faith Middleton Show. More delicious conversation after a quick break. Please stay with us. Faith Middleton with the gang. This is the Food Schmooze Party coming to you in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR. That's FaithWNPR. And to join the conversation with us on Facebook, search The Faith Middleton Show. All right, here we go. A couple more tricks and tips, and then our vegetable theme there is a reference to Lust for Leaf. That's the name of the cookbook, and how to make a po' boy without seafood in sight. There are no oysters in this. We're going to give you a crunchy mushroom filling for your po' boy. Oh, boy. And it was good. It was really good.
Very good.
Okay, a couple more tricks and tips. For eggs, I get these fresh eggs, and then I boil them, and I try to peel them. And it
Forget
is
it.
A mess. I mean, you just cannot get them off, and it's frustrating. So,
you got a tip for that?
Yeah, I do. This is from Judy Puckett, Seattle, Washington, and she says, because these hard-cooked eggs can be difficult, whether they're super fresh or not, especially it's when the shell shatters into a million pieces. So she taps the surface of the cooked egg with the back of a teaspoon. That cracks the shell.
Okay.
And then she slips the edge of the spoon, you know, face down, under the shell at the egg's base to loosen it, and then continues to move it along the curve of the egg to remove the rest of the shell.
You are kidding me.
How's that?
Like avocados.
That's definitely
just like an avocado.
That's a great idea.
That is a great idea.
Okay. I peel them underwater.
That's a good way, too.
I've tried that.
It doesn't
with
always
a newer
work. It's a little
egg,
bit better.
Yeah. And it did not work, but I'm going to try this.
That's
okay.
A perfect
one. Chris, I love the idea of using one thing for another purpose.
This
go
is
ahead.
A good one.
Fire away.
This is a good one. And this comes from Craig Beach of Morgantown, West Virginia. And he cleans and saves the plastic tops to cough medicine bottles. You know, the ones where you measure.
Oh,
and
no.
They actually
one
have
teaspoon, two
half
teaspoon.
A teaspoon. It goes all the way up. And everyone knows, well, not everyone, but I know that, and maybe people know that 1 ounce is 2 tablespoons. So it's a great way to measure a tablespoon.
Yeah, it's quick, and it's so you're not being careful with your spoon as you're walking over.
Are you like that? I have shaky hands, so if I can do dry, I can put dry. I can't put liquid in a teaspoon or a tablespoon because by the time it gets in the bowl, it's all spilled out.
Plus, you've got two, three people cooking in the kitchen, a bunch of people over, and they say, can I help? And they've all got jobs. Everybody is crashing into everybody in the kitchen.
So this is a great way, and then they stack nice and neat. So I'm going to start doing that, too. That's a great idea.
One more thanks to Cook's Illustrated, because this is something that I wish I had. The other night, I knocked over a glass of red wine, and it spilled on a very expensive fuchsia blanket from France that I treasure. I am so careful with this thing. I'm meticulous with this thing.
And then I thought
I was going to have a heart attack. Really, I seriously did. So I did race to the sink and went through soaking after soaking after soaking after soaking, and I finally got almost every. If you were very, very careful in your looking, you would see there's a little something there. But I wish I'd had this, because Cook's Illustrated decided to test these red wine stain removers.
And
they
ones.
Said, you know, they had this one and that one. There's no point in going through the whole thing. The only one that took away red wine stain from a piece of carpet without help from water or another cleaning product is called Wine Away. And I think that the 12-ounce bottle is about $11 or so. And so we've got a link for you on our website, Wine Away. If red wine is an issue for you, I know there are people who have parties.
I can attest to that.
People have parties and furniture that's white, and they won't serve red wine.
Yeah.
They won't allow it in the house. They only serve white wine.
It's hard to get out. It really is. I know from experience.
All right. We're going to go now to Lust for Leaf. This is a book that is filled with veggie crowd pleasers if you want to get your picnics going, your potlucks going, or your ragers going. So all vegetarian stuff. Our guest is Alex Brown. Alex Brown and Evan George are known as Hot Knives, and you can find them blogging on urbanhonking.com.
That's great.
Okay, so Alex Brown, welcome to the Food Schmooze.
Hello.
Hey, it's great to have you with us. So can't wait to dig into this. I should say that Alex and Evan refer to themselves as mezcal swilling Martha Stewarts. I forgot to add that.
So that's a good description.
Yeah.
I want to know them.
We're about to, at least one of them. I thought this was a really cool idea. We're going to do a couple mushroom things here because we've got the mushroom po' boy. But you do a mushroom ceviche.
Yeah.
That's very cool. So you get a combination of all kinds of mustards, oyster, white beech, brown beech, crimini, and then you add in, I suppose you could just get any kind of bunch of mushrooms you want, some radishes, cilantro, jalapenos, chilies.
Yeah, the radishes are pretty crucial. That kind of gives it a little bit of an extra sort of fishy funk, but...
And then you do the marinade.
Yeah.
You've got lime juice and olive oil and sea salt and onions.
Yeah, there's a huge amount of ceviche diversity in Los Angeles, as one would expect. And it's definitely something that, you know, thinking about how to rejigger that to be a cool vegetarian dish is not always easy.
And the
one
thing,
gets bored of tofu and lime.
Yeah, and you're in a climate that's a lot friendlier than the one we're in at the moment.
Agreed.
But I will say that there is a point in winter that even when it's cold, but you are tired of the traditional winter things. And when someone comes out with something sporty, you know, you say, well, that's fun. And so a mushroom ceviche would be really pretty great. So.
Yeah, and think about it as, you know, it's also a it's a preemptive remedy for all of you, you know, you winter people out there.
Oh, thanks so much. You want to just
house on a ton of lime juice. And, you know, making like a good leche del tigre is like, that's a more like Peruvian vibe for ceviche, but you know, any sort of marinade like that, I mean, I'm sure that you'll find different ways to use it, but the leftovers, like, you'll be slipping it out of the bowl. And it's a really good way to fight off the cold.
So we're going to go now to another oyster thing, and then we'll come back and do a couple things because we're on the oyster theme. This was pretty interesting. This is a po' boy, which would normally have fried oysters in it and a few other things, and it's a sandwich. But you recommended doing it with oyster mushrooms. Now, we kind of adapted this a little bit, and we're using portobello mushrooms that we slice because the oyster mushrooms ended up being $24, and we thought these are getting to be pretty expensive sandwiches.
So
we know you won't mind, but in any case, we know you do it with oyster mushrooms. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, totally. I mean, and again, that's like a very simple, like, one-off, you know, use oyster mushrooms instead of oysters, yuck. But oyster mushrooms, one of the advantages, not just climate-based, of living in Los Angeles is we have this, like, crazy access to all these great Southeast Asian markets. And the mushroom selection at all these markets is out of this world. And so for us, like, oyster mushrooms are dirt cheap. Sorry to rub it in. But we,
that's the second time.
Oyster mushrooms generally, like, they have a lot of, one reason why we prefer using them, especially for this application, is that they can have a lot of different kinds of textures. And so in this recipe, you're roasting them briefly to sort of get the flavors to start to condense and release a little bit of the moisture. And then you're doing, like, a very traditional, like, sort of low country, like, fried dredge action to get them nice and crispy and crunchy.
And so you've got that crunch, and you've got actually more meatiness than you would have with oysters.
Totally. I mean, the portobello works just fine. I mean, and you could use cremini, you could basically use any mushroom that you have available to you, and the technique is basically the same, where, you know, you want to sort of sweat them in the oven a little bit, and then you can fry them. Portobello fries is a recipe that was in our last cookbook, and that's another thing that sort of pops up on a lot of weird menus out of here in Los Angeles. So portobellos hold up very, very well to frying. The lightness and the crunch and the, like, sort of potentially off-putting goo that's inside, that's kind of the fun rub with the oyster mushroom po' boy. When you have this tangle of fried mushrooms, you bite into it, it's a little like biting into a bunch of fried oysters.
Can I just say potentially off-putting goo, I think, is a new phrase for our show.
That's great.
Oh, yeah. We tend to get gross. I think one of the other...
Yes, that's right.
I mean, part of... There's all these, like, dumb words that are being thrown around now. Like, food porn is, like, this, like, recognized trope. So, like, why not just, like, make it a little bit grosser for everybody and we can have some laughs?
There you go. Yeah.
I like it.
So, me too.
So we very easily figured out how to make this recipe gluten-free because you've got hoagie buns and there are all kinds of gluten-free breads available if you can't use the hoagie buns. And this has shredded green cabbage, as po' boys often do, a remoulade, a Louisiana hot sauce. And instead of all-purpose flour and cornmeal, we used a little cornstarch and cornmeal, and it all became gluten-free. Really, that was really fun to eat. And we put tons of hot sauce on it and had a ball.
Yeah.
Really good.
That's good.
So this is your fake-out burger.
Uh-huh.
This is made with extra firm tofu, olive oil, soy sauce, portobello mushroom, shiitake mushroom, onion, a can of garbanzo beans, chickpeas, medium-sized white potato, one red beet, some ground fresh black pepper, and some sea salt. What do you do with this?
Well, the idea was we wanted to try to, like, sublimate, you know, the mediocrity of the veggie burger. And we didn't really know how to do that. And one thing that we were really trying to think about was how can we sort of simulate or copy or fake the really great Maillard reaction that happens on the crust of the burger. Because usually when you get a veggie burger, it's this one textured, kind of lump that feels like you're eating bread on bread, and there's usually never a good char on it. And so what we were trying to figure out was, well, how can we sort of pack it with a lot of these, like, base umami flavors? And that's where the mushrooms are coming in. And then how can we get it to get that really savory crust? And one way to do that, once you've assembled the patty, and the potatoes there is a binder, the garbanzo beans there is a binder, but it's a much looser patty, like trying to sort of simulate a more, like, rare, like, hand-packed hamburger patty. And when you cook soy sauce, especially when it's, like, soaked into something, it toasts really nicely and leaves this kind of flavorful char that was the main goal of the burger. But then, you know, just for kicks, and again, for fun, we throw, like, sliced marinated beets in the center so that when you cut it open or bite into it, there's a, you know, there's a trace of, quote-unquote, blood.
That's great.
Makes me hungry.
Yeah, you know.
Oh, boy. All right, so let me jump over to this thing here. You've got something called rumorized pineapple.
Yeah.
And this sounds really good to me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's kind of actually a joke. Like, it's not a joke. It's us copying a flavor combination that I actually learned at work. So my day job, Evan actually is he's a radio producer for KCRW.
Yeah.
And I'm a specialty food importer and distributor. And there's a product from France that we work with. It's like a pre-made compote of pineapple, vanilla bean, and coconut. And the flavors, like, seem, like, so silly and pina colada-y at first. And then, I mean, like, the first time you have a pina colada, like, you get why people are obsessed with them. And with all the pie recipes, we wanted them to all kind of be, like, cocktails or, like, at least, like, alcoholic pies.
So,
apricot pie has mezcal in it. And the cherry pie is, like, supposed to be a riff on the Manhattan.
Very good.
Pineapple is just such a great flavor, especially when it's done right. But what you do in the recipe is you sort of pan roast the pineapple a little bit with probably a little bit more vanilla than you think is necessary. And, you know, you're scraping real beans, so it's got a lot of flavor. And butter. And then you sort of finish it for a quick flambé and braise with Haitian rum.
Nice.
Which, I mean, there's no other rum to me. But it's so flavorful and deep and full of dead souls that, you know, you really, really get something extra out of it. I recommend throwing all of your rum away and only buying
Haitian rum.
Barbancourt. If you're in, like, some sort of, like, voodoo society, like,
yeah.
Barbancourt is how you toast your initiation. And it's the only, you toast everything with Barbancourt in Haiti. So,
well, that's reason enough right
rum.
There.
Celebration, death, everything is Barbancourt. So it's a lively spirit.
So this makes, believe it or not, a tartlet.
Yeah.
So,
it's not in a glass?
That's kind of the filling, you know, vanilla beans, butter, pineapple, you know, dead spirits. And then we make sort of like a faux vegan, like, pastry cream using coconut milk and kudzu starch, which is a really active root starch from a Japanese root, the kudzu. And it thickens up really nice, and you can sort of use that as a base for, you know, what are sort of traditional fruit tarts where you just have a thin, short crust.
Where do you get kudzu?
And then fruit.
Where do you get kudzu starch?
Kudzu starch, you could get it if you guys have, like, a Whole Foods or something like that out there. There's a company called Eden Foods.
Yeah, right.
And they sell kudzu starch.
Eden
it
Foods.
It is fun to play with. Like,
wow.
You'll find a lot of applications for it because it's soluble in cold and hot liquid, and it'll gel up real nice.
Well, I just want to say that this rumorized pineapple tart, as soon as you got through the pineapple, vanilla bean, the rum, and the butter, before we even got to the tart shell, I thought to myself, stop right there, because I'm about to then scoop this over ice cream.
Oh, yeah.
Or sorbet,
sure.
Depending on what you want to do. Coconut sorbet with this on top, to me, would be just killer.
Yeah.
Wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much,
yeah,
Alex.
Yeah, no problem.
Alex Brown, co-author with Evan George of Lust for Leaf, veggie crowd pleasers to fuel your picnics, potlucks, and ragers. The Food Schmooze on WNPR airs Wednesdays at 3 and 9 p.m., Saturdays at noon. We're online anytime. Find the recipes, food products, restaurants, value wines, and easy cocktails, plus our events. We feature them at WNPR.org. They're there now. Click on Programs for the Faith Middleton Show. Here's to pleasure, my friends, and remember, never eat more than you can lift. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.
Everybody eats when they come to mind.